Nummer två. Pust långsamt och djupt.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, welcome back to Amandla Radio. This is a rebroadcast from January 5th of this year and is a tribute to Bishop Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who had died just a week previous. Gwen?
Yeah, and we chose to rebroadcast this. We're spread a little bit thin. I think COVID is taking its toll on Amandla, and our once vibrant team has dwindled. We're hoping to be able to rebuild it. But in the meantime, Doug and I decided we needed a bit of a break this week and thought this was such a wonderful show, Doug, that you put together. We thought it would be relevant to rebroadcast it, but doubly relevant because one of the contributors to the show, who you will be hearing in a moment, Martha Gordon, was a contributor to a book that's recently been published called International Brigade Against Apartheid, Secrets of the People's War that Liberated South Africa. And Martha, who was a anti-apartheid comrade and friend of mine back in the day, went on to do some very clandestine work for the African National Congress, talked about her role in that in a book that focuses on that. And Doug and I are pleased to be able to say that Amandla will be co-presenting with the publisher Diraja Press the Canadian launch of the book on June 16th. So stay tuned for that, and stay tuned now for the tribute to Tutu.
We raise our hands and we say, we will be free! All of us!
When you thought, say, of a thing like apartheid, and you saw so many who seemed to be supporting the racist policies of the former government in South Africa, and you say, how are we going to change? Well, I always say to people, remember, the sea is actually made up of drops of water. That what you do where you are is of significance. It may just be that your act of courage encourages someone else who was slightly more apprehensive.
If you think you can stop us from becoming free, you are going to be stampeded. For until blacks are free, no one in this country is going to be free.
He was in New York City this morning when he heard the news that he had won the Nobel Peace Prize.
This award is saying that it recognizes that we in the South African Council of Churches are those who stand between South Africa and catastrophe.
I held on to non-violence in very large measure, I think, for strategic reasons. If we went the way of the armed struggle, that we probably would not stand too much of a chance against a government that was armed to the teeth. I did get to the point of saying, I am not a pacifist, but that I was a peace lover and a peace advocate.
Because of the conflict of the past, no matter on which side we stood, we all stand in need of healing.
The truth shocks. The truth traumatizes. And it's not easy. It's never easy to forgive. It's never easy to be reconciled. It's not cheap. It cost God the death of his son.
I could say I have the right to retribution. When I forgive, I say I jettison that right and I open the door of opportunity to you to make a new beginning.
When you show compassion, when you show caring, when you show love to others, do things for others in a wonderful way. You have a deep joy that you can get in no other way. You suddenly feel a warm glow in your heart because you have, in fact, wiped the tears from the eyes of another.
He laughed. He cried. He was forgiven. He forgave.
Dear friends, comrades, and all listeners, I'm Doug Miller, and you're listening here to Amandla Radio at CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. This Amandla Radio comes every week Wednesday night with news and analysis and briefings about the continent of Africa that you will not get from the mainstream press. What you've been listening to just before I came on is the late Archbishop Desmond Mpilo Ntutu in his own words. He died on December 26th in his 90th year. The Arch, as he preferred to be called, was beloved of literally all South Africans, except those to whom he spoke the plain truth about their unsavory practices. There are so many tributes to the Arch that we are privileged and honored to have an Amandla special insight from a fellow Anglican Church minister in Johannesburg, Martha Gordon, a Canadian and an old friend of our own, Gwen Schulman, from their days as student anti-apartheid activists in the 1980s. I've also chosen short tributes from another Anglican minister, Father Michael Lapsley, himself a famous faith-based opponent of apartheid, and another tribute from a secular admirer and friend of the Arch, Albie Sachs, a remarkable and noted lawyer and ANC militant. In between episodes of the show, I'm playing a bit of music. The first piece begins with a small speech from the Arch explaining the meaning of the concept of Ubuntu, the Zulu or Xhosa word for human, followed by the Cape Town Youth Choir singing a hymn in his honor called Precious Lord. The other two songs are versions of the song Hambakale, which means simply go well or go in peace, sung mostly at funerals. The first is a township jive version, and the second is the ANC choir, the African National Congress choir from the 1970s. Normally the name of the person who passed away appears after the words Hambakale, but in the ANC version, it's dedicated to comrades who fell in the struggle and offers solace to Umkhonto Wesizwe, the spear of the nation, or the warrior who has passed fighting for others. Let's begin with Martha Gordon, a most remarkable person. Like Gwen, she was an anti-apartheid activist when she was a student. Gwen here at McGill and Martha at Carleton University in Ottawa. They both traveled throughout the frontline states in 1988 as part of a tour organized by CIDMA, the Center for Information and Documentation about Mozambique and Afrique Austral, as Southern Africa is known in French. And it was to familiarize young militants with the nature of the South African struggle firsthand by meeting ANC comrades and seeing the impact on the frontline states of the apartheid regime's brutal campaign to destabilize and sabotage the development of countries like Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Tanzania, and Zambia, because they supported the freedom struggles of the South African people. Gwen came back to Canada to finish her studies and build the Amandla Radio show, and Martha disappeared from the scene. Little did Gwen know that she had been recruited to work as an operative of the ANC's military wing and began smuggling arms into South Africa from Zimbabwe. That story has only just come to light with the publication of a book late in 2021, The International Brigade Against Apartheid, Secrets of the People's War that Liberated South Africa. I was gobsmacked to learn of this invaluable and terribly dangerous contribution of these brave men and women, and we will be bringing you in the near future a more detailed interview with two people featured in the book, Martha Gordon herself and an old friend of mine, Sue Gott. Martha spoke with us yesterday from Johannesburg in South Africa after a long day of tending to her parishioners in three congregations for which she's responsible in the Gauteng area. As a minister of the Anglican Church of South Africa, and even before she became a reverend, her path crossed with the Arch a number of times. Here is her story, told with passion and eloquence and honor and respect for a man who meant so much to her and the people of South Africa, and for that matter, the people of the world. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades. I'm here tonight with Martha Gordon, who is in South Africa. She's an Anglican priest there, and she therefore knew the Reverend Tutu by virtue of that affiliation. And so we are privileged to have her here. And I'm also with Sue Gott, an old friend and comrade from the anti-apartheid struggle and the CUSO days, Canadian University Service Overseas days. So Martha, I want to offer you our condolences. We are as sad as anybody about the loss of Reverend Tutu. Could you just tell us, I'm sure he was very important to you personally. Could you just tell us a little bit about how you got to know him, how you came to be with a part of his sphere of what's going on in the world?
Yes, well, thank you so much, Doug, and good evening to you and all the listeners, and good evening to Sue too. And yes, well, Archbishop Tutu, or fondly known as the Arch, was such a beacon of hope to millions of people all around the world. And I first heard him speak in his presence in the 1980s when he spoke in Toronto. And it was just incredible. He had won the Nobel Peace Prize, and he was encouraging Canadians to support the various campaigns, the economic sanctions, the diplomatic sanctions, and the release of political prisoners and so on. And he was one of many leaders who inspired so many of us Canadians to get involved in the anti-apartheid student movement and to do everything we could to raise the profile of the liberation work that was happening, the ANC and other progressive forces. And so it was only many, many years later that I met him in South Africa. And I wasn't even a priest at that point. I was working for the Cancer Association, and he had agreed to support one of our campaigns to encourage men to go for prostate checkups. And also we had a campaign, shave or spray your hair a different color in order to show support for cancer survivors. And he, being a prostate cancer survivor, was so happy to lend his support and encouragement to that cause. And he was just such a humble and amazing person. We met before an interview. And so for me, it was just an honor and a privilege to meet with him. But years later, as I was called to be a priest and later was ordained and got involved in growing the ministry, I met him. We had a special 85th anniversary celebration at our cathedral here in Johannesburg for him. And I didn't meet him again personally. I mean, I walked in, we were all processing down the aisle, and he was sitting at the front with Mama Leia, and we were supposed to walk facing the cross so you don't look and chat at people. But I had this sense that I just needed to show respect to him. So I turned to him and I did a bow and looked at him, and he looked at me in the eye. So, oh my gosh, I'll never forget that moment. I'm getting goose chills thinking of it. It was just like such love and kindness looking at me. It just like was an amazing feeling. So yes, we as Anglicans, but as South Africans, as people of the faith, many faiths, he was very much an ecumenical leader. So you might have heard of his wonderful relationship with the Dalai Lama, but it's such a loss for the country, but also it was a time to celebrate. He was very frail and not well for some time. So in a sense, he's at peace now, and we just love him for all that he's done. And the challenge now really for us as South Africans is to shine his light and do whatever we can to follow in his footsteps. Even if we can do one aspect of the many things that he did, we will make the world a better place.
Well, That's a tremendous tribute. Could you even talk a bit about those various roles that he played? Because it was many hats that he seemed to wear, and like you said, he was there in Canada in the 80s talking to people in schools and stuff. He was everywhere.
He campaigned all over the world, but he never forgot his roots and his people. And there have been so many amazing tributes about the life that he led. So it's not just the high-profile speeches and campaigning. That was, yes, a very important part. In a sense, that after he won the Nobel Peace Prize, he became an international celebrity and icon in many ways, but he also became public enemy number one in terms of the apartheid government. So he was at a high risk of being assassinated. And they even alluded to it in the newspapers here on Sunday, but the apartheid government, it is said, I don't know where they got the information, that they decided not to assassinate him because of the international ramifications. So in a sense, he had a bit of protection and he could speak out quite a lot more than a lot of other activists and leaders. So also he went to visit the people in distress. So there were many examples that people shared that when he was overseas, if there was a massacre or atrocity, he would take the next flight and come back and be with the people, often in very, very difficult situations when his life was threatened or it wasn't safe. He wouldn't hesitate to go in. And there's that famous case in D'Souza where he and another cleric saved a man's life. He was going to be necklaced and killed, and he saved the man's life. And that's something he stood out for, truth and justice. And even so he spoke out against apartheid. He spoke out against the many, many atrocities, and he pushed for sanctions. And at that time, you would be jailed for doing so. But he was able to come back in the country and still live. Listen, he had a difficult life in many ways living in South Africa, but he had a bit of protection in terms of that he was well known. So there was some protection in that, but his family paid a price. And I'm just trying to think of other examples. So later, once he retired as Archbishop, our first president, the late great Nelson Mandela, asked him to chair the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which he did, and that was 1996, and he did that for approximately 6 years. And that was really grueling, and it was something that the nation really needed to hear what some of the stories. It was only a fraction of what went on, but it was part of that process was to bring about information and knowledge about the atrocities that were committed, but also the healing that needed to take place and the understanding that needed to take place. There's been quite a bit of criticism that the TRC didn't go far enough, and certainly Tutu would agree with that in the sense that there should be prosecutions in many, many, many cases. And many cases, of course, never saw the light of day, never came to fruition. So that is a huge challenge, but I think it was a step. It was an important step, and he really led it in an incredible way. The other issues that he stood up for, apart from anti-apartheid campaigning and the cause for healing, was the cause for peace, not just under apartheid, but throughout. Violence against women and children he spoke out against. He spoke out against the terrible discrimination and violence against the LGBTQI plus community. And he's also spoken out against child marriage. He's also promoted healthy lifestyles. He's promoted many, many causes, as I even mentioned, cancer, being a cancer survivor. He's a TB survivor. He had polio. So he knows what it's like to be on the edges of society. And he always also spoke out against racism and injustice and poverty. So he's been a huge advocate of changing the economy and society to be a caring and kind society. And he's spoken out against corruption. So he's been really vociferous against government officials who have been found guilty of corruption, including our previous president, Jacob Zuma. So, and he was very critical of former President Thabo Mbeki, of the lack of action on HIV and AIDS. And so that's another cause that he was very, very passionate about, was access to HIV and AIDS medicine, but also prevention, care, and support and treatment, obviously. So, he supported that treatment action campaign, which was seen as an anti-government group. But of course, it was really integral in changing how the government looked after people affected and infected with HIV AIDS. And the government then rolled out one of the best programs in the world. So, you know, he was part of promoting change, promoting action, promoting truth and justice and peace wherever he could. And I think, too, that he always said he was going to retire and relax and spend time with his family. But he tried many times to do that, but kept speaking out. But the last couple of years, he's really not been well enough and strong enough to say much. But,
Wow, what a long list of accomplishments, just absolutely amazing. And the contribution is enormous. Just listening to the things you said, obviously we know about the Nobel Peace Prize, but then you hear about all these things that are accumulative that build to it, and you realize what a great man he truly was. I was fascinated by the way you said he was protected. Many another famous leader would have been taken away by the South Africans were quite ruthless, and he still managed to stand up and speak. And you've explained it, but I'm still quite astounded that he was able to be so bold and manage not to get eliminated in a number of ways that the South Africans were famous for doing. Do you think there's one thing that stands out as his biggest accomplishment?
I think his biggest accomplishment was being the voice of the voiceless. That's what Mandela liked to call him, because he always stood up for the underdog, and he wasn't a big man at all, very, very tiny, but he had a big voice, and he wasn't afraid to laugh or to cry or to shout with anger. I mean, he wept, and in a sense, for a generation of especially men, he made it okay to cry and to show emotion. And he had a cute, wonderful sense of humor, and he made fun of himself and others. Even the Dalai Lama, I think the two of them hit each other and so on, or used to kid each other. But I think just being that voice, that strong voice of goodness, of healing, of justice, of truth, you just feel there's hope for the country. Even in the most darkest times, he was a voice of hope. And I think a lot of that is to do with his spirituality, how he grew up in a very loving, kind home. And neighbors speak of when he grew up, he used to help others. He was kind. You know, it's how he lived out his life. It wasn't like an act. He really was that kind and caring person. Even for his own priests, he would call them, he would care for them. In the service on his funeral service on Saturday, the bishop who was even got teary explaining how Tutu couldn't be at his wife's funeral but sent this bouquet of flowers and called him. He was a pastor's pastor in the sense he phoned his priest. Apparently he prayed five times a day, including a Eucharist, which is a special service with the bread and wine representing Christ's body and blood. But he got up at 4:30 in the morning. Apparently, his priest, when he was bishop in the Diocese of Johannesburg, he had a photo of each of his priests. So when he prayed for them, he could see their picture. That's how caring he was. Frank Chikane, the great leader of the South African Council of Churches, was poisoned, and he was in America. And Frank was relaying this story that he was so sick, he was unconscious for 12 hours. And as soon as Archbishop Tutu heard, he couldn't obviously be immediately in Wisconsin. He sent a local Episcopalian bishop there to pray with Frank, even though Frank was unconscious. So when Frank miraculously awoke and saw this bishop in full regalia praying, he was a bit taken aback. He thought maybe he was, somewhere else. But Frank was using that as an example of how much he cared for his people and his colleagues and his family and friends and communities.
Wow. It's a powerful role that he played. It doesn't look like there's a lot of people around to fill those shoes. And where to South Africa in the absence of that voice?
That's a great question, because a lot of people have been saying this is the end. Even Mama Grasso Michelle was saying this is the end of that sort of caliber, that generation of leaders. But hopefully, I'm a person of hope, and that young people hearing about Tutu's life, and they're amazing. There are so many amazing people in South Africa doing wonderful work. So I was encouraging my congregation on Sunday to just follow one example of what Tutu did, and we can do that. We might not be able to do a lot of what he did. He was just such a one-of-a-kind, remarkable man, but he was human, and we can learn from him and follow at least one or two of his attributes, and that will make a huge difference.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm hopeful about South Africa. You've called it an interesting time, because today the acting Chief Justice Raymond Zondo presented the first three parts of the Zondo Commission of the inquiry into state capture. So he presented that in Parliament to President Cyril Ramaphosa. It's been 4 years since the inquiry started, and this is a really, really important day in the history of South Africa, in the sense that corruption, as the president said, that this is the official end of the period of state capture. Now, obviously, there's a long way to go. The final report has to be tabled, and then all the recommendations need to be put into action. But hopefully, we're going to see a renewal and turnaround of the country. But we need voices like Archbishop Tutu. Critical support, as we used to say in the anti-apartheid days, critical support. So yes, we applaud that there's an inquiry, but we must hold the government accountable and all civil society, including the religious community. And our own Archbishop Mahoba, Thabo Mahoba, has been very good in criticizing the government and pushing for more change, especially on the issue of this absolute abject poverty that we're seeing in the country, which has worsened since COVID. I mean, it's just astronomical. And what can we do as South Africans, and how can we live a modest lifestyle? That's the other thing that Tutu did, was he lived a very modest lifestyle, even symbolically wanted only the cheapest coffin available, only one bouquet of flowers, of carnations from his family, rope handles on the coffin, and he didn't want an elaborate funeral or any kind of celebration. And then, I mean, any kind of like pomp and ceremony, that kind of thing. It was a very traditional Anglican service with some secular elements, because it was a level one in terms of government support. But it was the first time that the church actually led a government supported funeral. So that tells you a lot about about his lifestyle, his way of living, and we have to do more. We all have to do more.
Wow. I don't know that there's much to add after a passionate presentation like that, Martha. I thank you so much for it. Any last words before we part?
Just to say that Tutu recognized the importance of the international community and international solidarity of every person who was somebody who stood for justice and truth. And so even though he was a cleric, he was really of the attitude that we are all born in God's image. We are all children of God, and we are all equal, and we are all loved by God, whatever you want to call God, whatever faith or not faith. So we are all part of this human family. And we are all originally from Africa. He was a big believer in promoting that idea. We all originated in Africa. And so we are all brothers and sisters in this human family. So we need to care for one another and love one another and be gentle with one another. And that's something he lived out. And I think the love he showed and the love he received, he wanted that love to be then reciprocated or multiplied all over to one another. So if we can just take his example of love and shine that light like a beacon of hope for everyone, anyone who's struggling, but anyone who's maybe doing okay, they can share that okayness with others. So I'm really, really hopeful that we can look at his life, reflect on his life, but live out his dream and make it a reality. One of the, Frank Chikane, I mentioned, he said Archbishop Tutu was very, very distressed at how things were going in the country. And Frank said to him, "Don't worry, we'll take care of things." So I'm going to also be part of that to say to him, wherever he is, "Don't worry, we will take care of things. We will turn things around and make not only South Africa, but the whole world a better place." And the international community, including Canadians, have such a wonderful role to play, and they have played such a role. They must continue and step it up, not just in Canada, but around the world. So I'm hopeful, and together we can be stronger as a world.
Martha Gordon, I thank you so much for this wonderful insight. Absolutely eloquent. Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
And so Ubuntu says, my humanity is bound up in yours. I am only because you are. And we then say, a person is a person through other persons.
Precious
interview was over, Martha wrote to me and almost apologized because she had forgotten to mention the Arch's commitment to environmental justice and his outspoken support for the liberation of the Palestinian people from Israeli apartheid, the brutality of Israeli apartheid. She just couldn't cover all of his concerns. And that's the kind of man he was, involved in anything that touched on justice. Michael Lapsley is a New Zealander who came to South Africa as a young Anglican minister in 1973 and quickly became a thorn in the side of the apartheid regime. He supported the student struggles that erupted with the Soweto uprising in June 1976, and by September of that year, the regime deported him. Rather than run home to the safety of New Zealand, he chose to carry on his work supporting the student and the black resistance to apartheid. He simply crossed the border to neighboring Swaziland, now known as Eswatini. That was still too close for the paranoid racist, and they tried to eliminate him with a parcel bomb that cost him both his arms. He survived and is a liberation icon in his own right. Here's what he said of the ARC, Desmond Tutu, after his passing in an interview on ENCA News Network in South Africa.
Let's go back to our conversation with Father Michael Lapsley. And again, my apologies for that brief interruption there, Father Lapsley. But let's pick up the conversation. You had just reflected on your own reaction upon receiving the news of the passing of the late Archbishop Emeritus Desmond Tutu. What did he mean to you?
Well, he played a very special part in my own life. I first met him just after I'd been expelled from South Africa in September of 1976. And he just not long before that had become Bishop of Lesotho. So he was my bishop and subsequently my archbishop. But I think out of my own woundedness, I drew very close to him. And he was part of the inspiration to start the Institute for Healing of Memories. And, you know, we say our first principle is that we are all spiritual beings of infinite worth and value. And Archbishop Tutu preached that and lived that. He, the way he responded to people, he helped us all to feel better about ourselves. I always remember these amazing sermons on Christmas Eve when he was Archbishop, and his voice would reduce to a whisper, and his own inimitable Tutu way, he would say, God loves you and you and you. And we all went out feeling, yes, we're all God's children. And I think I've profoundly admired the way not only was he against apartheid, but particularly in our church, he championed the rights of women to be ordained as priests and become bishops. And also then, and not always popularly for that, championed the rights of LGBTIQIA plus people as well, because he believed, he even said, I don't want to go to heaven if the LGBT community are not going to be there. So I love the way he embraced all of us in the fullness of our humanity, and also in which he believed profoundly, and we as a wounded people needing to be on the journey of healing.
Yeah.
So in a way, the world, and also he wrote a book saying God is not a Christian. So also he celebrated that people of all faiths are God's children equally.
Mm. Father Lapsley, His contribution in terms of, you know, the struggle against apartheid, the citation for his 1984 Nobel Peace Prize says it is for, quote, for his role as a unifying leader figure in the nonviolent campaign to resolve the problem of apartheid in South Africa, end quote. Now, you know, in terms of unifying leader figure, that you understand, but the part that talks about resolving the problem of apartheid in South Africa was debated at the time. Should a Christian leader have been so vocal against the government at the time and speaking out consistently and quite loudly for that matter? And post-apartheid, you also saw echoes of that whenever he would be raising issues from time to time. You would hear a retort. It wasn't the dominant retort, certainly not from the governing party, but it was there, that would say if he wants to enter politics, he should put down his robes and enter politics officially. I'm pretty sure you are familiar with what I'm talking about. Just talk to me about that role and how he understood that role.
Well, I think to Lizizwe, he had read from Genesis to Revelation. And he saw very clearly that justice and worship are two sides of the same coin. If we worship God, our worship plays itself out in a commitment to justice. So he was never into party politics as a priest, as an archbishop, but he was unfailingly committed to social justice as an imperative of the gospel. He'd heard Jesus say, "I've came to preach good news to the poor, to free the captives, to set free the oppressed, to bind up the brokenhearted." So in a way, it was convenient for the forces of darkness to try and dismiss him and say that is about politics. In the apartheid era, anything that was to do with real life was called politics. But Tutu was much bigger than that, and his voice cut through that kind of humbug from the apartheid regime.
And if I can just now sort of draw our conversation towards this particular theme of reconciliation in the face of undeniable atrocities. Let's talk about you personally for a moment. You testify before the TRC between the 1st and the 10th of June in 1996. He is the chairperson of the TRC at the time, and many of us remember that image, that long-lasting and abiding image of him, weeping at one of the hearings in East London. Just tell me about that, because there's no question that he knew your story. As you just said, you had been in Lesotho, and he was the Archbishop of Lesotho at a particular point in time in history. But just tell me about relating to him now, not as your Archbishop, but as this man who has such an important task, but also who needs to display a level of humanity that hopefully at that point would also become infectious across South Africa in transition.
Yeah, I mean, I was privileged in that my story was already quite well known. But when I gave evidence to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission with Archbishop Tutu sitting in the chair, I felt that my story had become, in its own small way, an indelible part of the story and the journey of the people of South Africa. And indeed, when I decided to start an Institute for Healing of Memories, it was started precisely as a parallel process to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, recognizing that that commission gave a platform to some, but reality was all of us, all South Africans of every shade and color and political persuasion, had a story to tell, and we'd all been wounded by apartheid. And that woundedness continues. So it's natural that in a way Archbishop Tutu became our patron, and in a way he'll continue to be our patron in heaven, continuing us to inspire us on the journey to healing and healing the wounds of history. And I just want to also echo other voices saying a part of a tribute to Archbishop Tutu would be to prosecute the last of the apartheid criminals, because in a way the failure of the state to prosecute undermined the whole logic of the commission that said everybody could seek amnesty, but if you didn't seek amnesty, you would face prosecution. So that unfinished business and also dealing with reparations completely will be part of our tribute to Archbishop Desmond Tutu.
And Father Lapsley, please expand a little bit more on that point, because part of the reason why the path of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was chosen at the time was that there was, one, a preference for a blanket amnesty, which was the preferred path of the NATS, the nationalist government at the time, and some of the people who were there representing that side of the argument, and the other side, which is some in the ANC and other liberation forces, preferred what would have been similar to the Nuremberg trials. And in the end, this is what was opted for and formalized, to say you are to come forward, speak the truth in its wholeness of your participation in any atrocities, and if you are deemed to have told the truth, you would be eligible for consideration for amnesty, but failing which, you would have to be prosecuted. It was statutorily founded. So just talk to me about that. Is it about seeking vengeance some 20, 30 years on from the TRC, or is it really about that unfinished business to say, actually, the process was meant to run to its logical conclusion in this way?
I think it's not about vengeance, it's about accountability. And the commission was set up as pro-victim. And we know that many of the families, whether we talk about the Craddock Four or the Tamils or so many cases of relatives who are still in profound pain because there has been no accountability. And that is not the failure of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission led by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Sadly, it's a failure of our democratic state. So we need to insist on that unfinished business, not so that elderly people go to prison, but that there is accountability. And that is what is important, and that will help heal the wounds of the past. And that we owe to Archbishop Tutu, we owe it to the relatives of the victims and the survivors.
All right. Let me, as a parting shot then, Father Lapsley, I imagine that if I were to ask you and give you a blanket check and say, write for us your anecdotes and your stories with the late Arch, would be here for the whole day. But perhaps one or two that you can share with us.
Let me tell you one nice story. You know, after F.W. de Klerk denied that apartheid was a crime against humanity, the Grote Kerk in Cape Town invited me to come and preach. And I said to the Archbishop, the Grote Kerk has invited me to come and preach. And I said that when I reached the pulpit, that I fear the ceiling would fall in. Archbishop Tutu's immediate response was, the angels would begin to sing. And that, in a way, embodies this humanity, infectious humor, this belief in all of us. So I have many beautiful memories of him. We sometimes fought, we sometimes disagreed, but there was a profound affection and, of course, on my part, admiration. But I'm also challenged to be a more spiritual being, because I think Archbishop Tutu, everything he did was soaked in prayer. When he spoke God's word, it came out of this profound spirituality. I see that Archbishop Tabo, in his comment earlier today, said Archbishop Tutu laughed with us, he cried with us, he wept with us. And so in a way, he was a prophet of our time, but a prophet for the whole human family. I've been receiving today messages from all over the world, and people offering condolences to me, because they know that we had a special and a tender relationship as well.
Albie Sachs was a stalwart of the ANC and eventually had to flee into exile, where he too still posed such a threat to the racist regime of South Africa that he was sent a parcel bomb to his home in exile in Mozambique, which tragically cost him his right arm and fingers on the other hand. He is a noted lawyer and jurist who was instrumental in helping the ANC shape the new constitution for a free South Africa. Here he shows the great respect that secular people had for the Arch. In addition to being a great ecumenical cleric, the Arch was highly regarded by communists and people who observed no religious customs, as Albee will illustrate. In addition, the Arch respected their contribution in the fight for Ubuntu, our common humanity, love, and goodness. This, too, is an interview on ENCA with South African News Network.
As we continue to reflect on the life and legacy of Archbishop Desmond Tutu, let's get some reaction from former Constitutional Court judge and anti-apartheid activist Albee Sachs. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Sachs. We really do appreciate it this evening. Perhaps speak to us about the important role that the Arch played in moving the country into democracy.
He was an extremely political figure, deeply engaged in transforming South Africa, bringing down apartheid, creating a new society. But he wasn't a politician. He wasn't attached to any particular political party. He supported the freedom struggle, the liberation struggle, wholeheartedly. It was important that he had that energy and force and strength. At the same time, he wasn't running for office. He had his own job. And he also had a very particular style. I haven't heard enough about it. A fantastic sense of humor, compassion. He humanized the liberation struggle in very specific ways. He humanized his profession. The Archbishop, instead of being a solemn, serious, rather pompous, stern person, he was full of fun. He said God had a sense of humor. I've never heard anybody say that. He didn't say it poking fun. He said it with enjoyment. That was part of fun and enjoyment and spirit, even in the darkest of times. These things were important. He paid great attention to his dress. I've been looking at all the newsreels now. I think only Winnie Mandela could compare with him in terms of the dress for the occasion. He had a fantastic sense of the media, the importance of the media, but not to play up to the media, to be himself in front of the media. I think nobody will ever forget during the TRC proceedings when he put his head down and he cried. These weren't fake tears. He didn't put it on, but he allowed himself to cry in public because the nation was crying. The story of Mtinkulu, whose hair came out because of the poisoning. Even the way he spoke, it liberated me. I'm very secular. We had a bond and attachment that was so strong, that was so powerful. Maybe he felt he could see certain godliness in me, and I could see a very strong secular side to him. Look at him moving. Moving. He's saying you don't have to be heavy to be a leader. You don't have to lash people with guilt and make them feel terrible about themselves. You can go through life with a spirit of positivity, of energy, of reaching out, connecting to others. And I think in that sense, that was the strength of his message. He was the messenger. He was the message. It was his style, his persona, his office. All of these things came together in a very magnificent personality, somebody I'm so proud to have had a connection with, to have worked with. He even gave me courage. He said God can have a sense of humor. I was able to open a decision for the court in the Laugh-It-Off matter. Does the law have a sense of humor? It's taking away that kind of pompousness and leaden quality that's associated with virtue, and saying virtue is fun. It's the human spirit. It's us. It's able to connect with other people. I remember him once being asked, Archbishop Tutu, do you have any regrets? And he said, yes. I often wondered what it's like to be tall. And I can tell you, I'm a tall person. I wish I could be like you, a shorter person, perky and bright and here and there and everywhere, connecting to the occasion, feeling with the people, and through the sheer goodness of yourself, not saintliness, ordinary human goodness of yourself, and your language and your connections and your demeanor and your dress, and understanding the occasion, you brought beauty into a world that was often very, very ugly. You brought humor into a world that's often very, very drear. You brought passion into a world that's often very, very formalistic and dry. So I think this is the way that Archbishop Desmond Tutu helped us liberate ourselves, helped the cause of liberation, not through denunciation, not through pomposity, not through slogans, but just through being himself and using all the opportunities that he would say God gave him, I might say that history gave him, to enable humanity to liberate itself, South Africa to move forward quite a lot, not as much as he would have liked, not as much as many of us would have liked. Viva Archbishop Dennis Desmond Tutu, viva, viva, viva. We owe you so much in this world. We enjoyed being with you so much.
People, why can't we just be kind and treat everybody with dignity?
And he said it in such a crisp and clear and sincere way. And it wasn't just you out there. It was we in the church. We are homophobic. We in the church are misogynistic. We in the church don't live up to our own ideals. And that's what made it so convincing, that it wasn't lessons that he, as a superior person, was imposing and throwing out there to the flock. It was a participant in life, a participant in the community activity, who was engaging and using his skills, and he was quite full of tricks, full of fun, full of provocation, but provocation not for the sake of causing upset, but for the sake of getting people to shake themselves out of a kind of somnambulism of doing things routinely and maybe being cruel in a routine way and receiving wisdom that was actually ugly and hurtful in relation to others.
Certainly, and I think if we can just end off, Mr. Sachs, one thing that truly stands out, just looking back at his life, is that very infectious laugh and reminding people that, yes, there might be some serious things going on in the world, but don't ever forget to laugh. Maybe just share a few moments that you had with the Arch, especially when he would laugh like that, and just remind people to enjoy the good side of life as well.
Well, you know, I remember very, very vividly at the Grahamstown Arts Festival, there was a march one day at the end of the festival up to the cathedral. And he enjoyed the fact that here was very secular L.B. Sachs in his cathedral. But he didn't just leave it there. They had branches. And the idea was for the clergy to wave the branches over the congregants to bless them. And he gave me a branch. And he said, Albie, I want you now. You must bless me. So he kind of, you know, the way that in jiu-jitsu, you upend your opponent, if you like, intellectually in terms of existential worldviews, getting me to bless him. And I did it with all generosity, maybe not having the same beliefs that he had. There you are. He's even laughing at the memory of that particular joke. And he wanted people to see the laughter, to hear the laughter. He wanted laughter to be real in life, because laughter is in a sense, an elixir of democracy, of humanity, of openness, of contact. And look at that beautiful costume that he's wearing. He could also look very sorrowful, and he could also cry. And he wanted all these human emotions to be part and parcel of the ideas and part and parcel of the gospel as he understood it, and as he propagated, reaching even to the heart of a secular person like L.B. Sachs.
Certainly, and I think the passion in his conduct always came through. Thank you so much for sharing those.
That's it for tonight on Amandla Radio here at CKUT 90.3 FM. Hambakale Desmond Mpilo Tutu, the Archbishop of the Anglican Church of Cape Town, South Africa, and a hero to so many of us, from not only the anti-apartheid struggle, but in defense of justice and human rights right up until his death. May he rest in peace. We'll be back again next week with more news and analysis from the continent of Africa. Stay tuned to these public service announcements about COVID. Stay safe and stay tuned to Jazz Euphorium. Amandla!
COVID-19 is quickly circulating throughout the province of Quebec. It's essential that you get tested only if you have COVID-like symptoms. Symptoms such as fever, cough, and loss of taste or loss of smell. As you may already know, testing still remains one of the best ways to limit outbreaks. For more information, visit quebec.ca/test COVID-19. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
This has been a rebroadcast of our Amandla special tribute to Bishop Desmond Tutu early in January. And stay tuned to Jazz Euphoria.
This is Tony from Planet Giza, and you're listening to CKUT Montreal Community Radio. This is the crib right here, so shout-outs to every station on here, and shout-outs to you, the listener. Don't go nowhere. We'll be right back.
Black Rose Books invites you to our book launch event.
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions.
Happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom?
The Fire That Time.
Insatiable Hunger.
The Forgotten Revolution.
And Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West, Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitalières en Transition and CKUT-FM.
Pangea de Futura is a mega jam collective comprised of many veterans of the Montreal music scene, a wide range of tectonic plates coming together, making the world stop for a second and ripping these continents apart. CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to present their concert in collaboration with CHYZ 94.3 on Sunday, May 22nd at 3 p.m. at the 38th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville. For all the details on the 38th FIMAV, visit fimav.qc.ca.
Are you ready?
Are you ready for the sound experience of a lifetime? Are you ready for crystal clarity in